Diane, would you mind starting? I'm going to ask this of both of you, but explain to us sort of what your experience is with the issues that we're talking about today and how you came to these issues.
Okay, well, thank you for that. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself traditionally. Buju Shwe Ganun Adishnakaz Adik Dodam. I'm from the Ojibwe Nation actually part of it is in the U.S. My grandmother is from Red Lake. And I'm from Shoal Lake First Nation 40. So how many of you have been to Winnipeg? Good. So when you have a shower, flush the toilet next time, you can thank a red sky because it's our First Nation that provides the water to the city of Winnipeg. And so that's how you can acknowledge us. And I'd also like to acknowledge the Anishinaabe territory that we all have the pleasure of being on. And I'd like to, that's important in, as an Indigenous person, and where we travel, we always need to acknowledge our brothers and sisters in other nations. So my work has been really since the last 20 years of working on the issue of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, and that's how I refer to it as. And one of the first questions is the difference between the two. So I will bring that context to it when it gets to that. But so in the last 20 years, I have been working directly on the front lines with survivors. I work for an organization called the Mama Wichita Center. And that organization, among many other Indigenous organizations in Winnipeg, have taken a lead on building resources for victims of sex trafficking, which in Canada are, in the Prairie provinces in particular, Indigenous women are the ones who are targeted by traffickers for the purposes of sexual exploitation. And so as a result of that, we started up one of the very first safe houses for teenage girls in Winnipeg. And we also operate the only rural healing lodge in Canada for victims of sex trafficking who are under the age of 18. And so I bring that wealth of information to this panel, as well as in 2013 and 14, I led a national task force on sex trafficking of women and girls in Canada. And that was, it's all online, 34 recommendations, simple actual recommendations on how to end sex trafficking. But that's also given me a national scope. And one of Canada's experts on the issue of sex trafficking. And I acknowledge my sister in crime, Joy Smith, who's also here today.
Nina, I'm really happy to be here. I always say when I'm at events like this that I sit in awe of my colleagues who are working directly with victims, our lawyers, our law enforcement, our service providers. I spend most of my time in an office across the street at my computer. So the work I do is I'm a teacher and I'm a researcher. I'm a trained historian in American history, and my original research was on American slavery in the 1850s in Mississippi. And, you know, that's something I felt passionate about and still do, especially when I'm teaching. But as I progressed throughout my career, I ended up back here in North Dakota. I'm originally from Grand Forks. And much like everybody in the state, we were kind of caught unawares when all of a sudden we had this boom and there was more attention paid to human trafficking that was going on in the state. So it seemed to me a good opportunity to put my historical research on slavery in conversation with what the kind of slavery that was going on in the state at this time. I also teach women and gender studies, where we spend a lot of time talking about exploitation of men and women and children. And so one of the core goals of women and gender studies scholars is what we would call praxis, taking the knowledge we gain and putting it into practical application on the ground. So not just knowledge for knowledge's sake, but knowledge to make change. And this was another good opportunity for me to take my academic skills and try to do something to make positive change in the larger society. So I just have a real passion for this topic, and it's many interconnected issues. I am doing a little bit of work right now with the North Dakota Human Trafficking Task Force on data collection, which is very fulfilling and exciting, and yeah, that's how I came to this topic.
Let's start with that more basic question, Diane, that you recognize, which is what are we talking about when we're talking about sex trafficking and exploitation? What does that mean?
Okay, well, thanks, and I really think that this is important, that we understand all of the complexities around human trafficking. First of all, labor trafficking and sex trafficking can can intersect. Oftentimes, if women are being promised a job, and then it'll evolve into sex trafficking. And so they are connected, and it can be, and many women do experience both at the same time. So that's important. The other thing I really think that's important is that you understand the framework and sort of where everything is at, because it ties into language and it ties into how we view the issue of sex trafficking. So when it comes to sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, there is what happens to children, and then there what happens to adults. And then who is doing the trafficking? There is a supply and a demand. And oftentimes they're not the same people. The supply are the traffickers, and the demand are the exploiters. And the demand are people who are buyers or the consumers. I have a whole bunch of other names for them that I'm not allowed to use in public often. So that's kind of like there's victims, and victims are children, they're adults, you know, and we'll get into a little bit later about who they are. And then there is a supply and the demand component. And it really is important that when you're looking at sex trafficking as it relates to children and as it relates to adults. And when I talk about children, I'm talking about under the age of 18. And because there are, for children, there is provincial legislation that gives both child welfare and organizations like the Mama Wichita Center some opportunity to intervene when a young girl is being recruited and lured. And so that we have some child welfare legislation that, in fact, we're the only one, again, in Canada that uses, it's called a Section 52 legislation, where it's in the Child Welfare Act, that if you are responsible for putting a child in need of protection, then you are committing a crime. And so it gives the child welfare the opportunity to intervene, and it also removes the child as being a requirement to be a witness as things progress, because exploiters and traffickers will never abide by a protection order 100% of the time. They will break it, and then they enter into the criminal justice system as a breach of that order. And then with adults, the provincial legislation that would apply to that is the prostitution legislation. And oftentimes, policing agencies will fall back on prostitution legislation when they need to intervene between a victim and their trafficker. And so there are some really important laws that exist in provinces as well as federally that apply to both children and to adults. And the other important thing to understand is that there's a difference between sexual exploitation on its own and sex trafficking. And the main difference is, in sex trafficking, there's actually a bad person that is forcing it to happen. And you need a third party, I call that the bad person, a trafficker, that is forcing, that is doing the recruitment and luring, that is really the supply part of the equation of supply and demand. And they are the ones that are really profiting off the sexual exploitation of women and girls. And so sex trafficking, regardless of whether it's child or adult, does require a bad a third party. In sexual exploitation, it doesn't. And sexual exploitation is oftentimes when women are... sometimes it starts off at sexual exploitation if both... either a child or a woman needs money. They need money to pay their rent. They need money for drugs or alcohol or something. And they're exchanging sex acts for that thing, whether it's money, drugs, a ride, alcohol, a place to stay, etc. Then there is that. Then it's sexual exploitation. There's no choice. Nobody's forcing her, but there really is no choice. In the fact that she needs money, and this is the only way she feels that she can get this. And it's really important as well to know the difference between when we're talking about children and we're talking about adults, because language now enters into the whole framework. Because when we're talking about children, oftentimes we're using the same words we would as adults. We call them even child prostitutes. that's awful if we're doing that as a society and normalizing the sexual exploitation and abuse of children. If you are a child prostitute, should never go together. Same with teen hookers should never go together, because it is these are children who are being sexually abused. Like, that's what's actually happening. And we minimize their victimization when we use those words like child pornography and child prostitute. And the same would go for child pornography. Like, what is... Those words should never be together either. And what many advocates like me across the country are really challenging people. And if there's one thing you take from my presentation today, is really be aware of language. Because language... really does stir something up in people. And so we minimize victimization of children when we say child pornography. Though that you're actually witnessing, if somebody's watching it, that's a crime scene that's happening. And these are child abuse images. It's not child pornography. So those words mean something. And then lastly, for adult women, is particularly if it's sexual exploitation or sex trafficking, you will never hear educated people like me on the issue of sex trafficking and exploitation ever say sex work or sex trade, because it is neither. When you understand the victimization and the control and how women are treated as commodity, then it's not work, and trade implies you're trading something of fair value, and it's neither. And so that is, I think, really important to begin the session today, to know the difference between the two and to understand the difference between when we're talking about children and we're talking about adults, and how we frame that and talk about it.
I have a question for you in light of that, because I think that's a really helpful starting point. But given your research experience with slavery in Mississippi in the South, I mean, we didn't talk about sex trafficking, right, when we were talking about the sexual exploitation of slaves. And yet it's, and sort of wondering kind of how you might tie some of what you've talked about. You've talked about trying to make that historical research and connect it to what was happening during the boom, in particular in North Dakota. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that.
Between, right, well, I think we'll probably talk a little bit about who are most vulnerable victims. And we know that, for instance, girls and women of color in the United States and elsewhere are more likely to be victimized by sex trafficking, in part because we have this long legacy of slavery in this country and of colonization. So if we look at African and African American slavery in the United States, here we have women who are literally bought to be potentially lifelong sex slaves, and many were used in that capacity. Or if you look at the history of colonization, we have many, many examples of indigenous women being used as, well, sexually exploited, commodified, sold as sex slaves by European and American colonizers. So that history is certainly carried out to the present day, where we still see these groups being overrepresented amongst sex trafficking victims.
In the beginning, when you talked as well, you said specifically that indigenous women are targeted by traffickers. Why? Why are they targeted? What makes them vulnerable to trafficking?
Know about sex trafficking and why it happens in the first place. Like, what are some of the root causes? And we know, like, it's rooted in greed and violence and misogyny. And those are the root causes. And who to target most is sex trafficking is more about power and control. And it's not even really about the sex at all. It's about men having power and control over women for a period of time. They feel they paid for it. They have a right to do whatever they want. In our society, we have created community of very specific cultures who are disposable women. In Canada, that's Indigenous women, and I would say in the United States, it's women of color and Indigenous women as well, that there is some stereotypes that we actually like violence, that it's okay. And in fact, Canada has over 1,200 missing and murdered Indigenous women that, again, are disposable women. So they're easy targets because society, and we all participate in that, We all participate in that in one way or another, where to feed those stereotypes of women who are, it doesn't matter what you do to them because nobody will care. There'll be no consequences, and that's the truth. There are almost no consequences when you violate particularly an Indigenous woman or a minority group. And so that's that breeds the fact that, and it actually contributes to creating vulnerability within those minority groups and make them easy targets for both the traffickers who are recruiting and luring and the men that are buying women and girls for sex. They're commodities, they're objectified, and they're free to do whatever they want with little consequences, and that's why it flourishes and is a lot, and happens and is targeted towards minority groups.
I'm going to digress for just a moment to put a plug in for the, I'm going to get the name of it wrong, the Human Rights Museum in Winnipeg. Is that the name? The Human Rights Museum. And there's a wonderful display about the 1,200 missing and murdered Indigenous women as represented by empty dresses, red dresses, in this vast plains as a real problem. And so I really encourage those of you who have not managed to make it up to that museum to do so. It's really quite powerful. Nikki, I want to come back to you as a historian. I'm sorry, I keep coming back to you for the history perspective here. How have things changed, right? We've talked about sort of the changing language, sort of we didn't talk about human trafficking, even though it was what we would now consider it then. We've talked about the incredible vulnerability of women of color, both in the United States and apparently in Canada as well. But how have things changed in the last, say, 10 to 20 years?
Well, I think some things really haven't changed in terms of who are the most likely victims, in terms of who the buyers are, also in terms of who the traffickers are. You know, we in North Dakota, we had the boom, and it got on everybody's radar, and I don't think we were paying close attention to it. At least the general public wasn't paying close attention to it before that. And so a lot of North Dakotans thought, well, this is new. This is just these outsiders are coming in. But if you go back and look at North Dakota history, and of course, if you look at the larger American history, it's been here since the beginning. It's just that now we're paying attention to it. And much like throughout history, I mean, you can think back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, in the Progressive Era, there was this white slavery panic, right, that it was white girls that were being trafficked. And so that raised the society's awareness. And I think to a certain extent, that was true during the boom as well, that it was white North Dakota girls who were at risk. And some certainly were and still are. But again, we often lose, historically, we lose sight of who we really should be keeping an eye on, who we should be talking about, who's most at risk, and what we can do to help prevent that. I think we also have some of the same attitudes that we had in the Progressive Era in regard to people who are caught up in the commercial sex trade. So oftentimes we tend to assume that these are free-willing, autonomous prostitutes who are bad or loose women who are coming and ruining our communities. And as Diane has pointed out, that this is a really problematic assumption to make about people who likely entered in their teenage years, if not younger, and have experienced childhood trauma, teenage trauma, adult trauma. It's much more complicated than that. I mean, I think maybe it's human nature. We want things black and white. Who's a victim? Who's not? Who's a deserving victim? Who's not? And when it comes to sex work or the commercial sex industry or sex trafficking, it's fuzzy. And that's why those definitions that Diane was clarifying earlier are so clear as well. I think oftentimes I see in the research I do, scholars aren't using the same definitions. Certainly when I do public outreach, there's confusion about, you know, what is modern-day slavery versus sex trafficking versus prostitution? How is it different between children and adults? So I think as a larger community trying to address trafficking, we need to figure this out and get some clear definitions. I imagine the lawyers out here, you've got precise definitions, but it doesn't always carry over to the larger society. And I'm getting off track like any good professor will do and talk about it, anything I want. You're asking about change in the last 20 years. I think probably, and maybe Diane will have a different view on this, what has changed most significantly is the methods by which traffickers reach their victims. And of course, the internet has been the biggest change there. So I often, when I'm talking to the public, recall how when the boom was going on, there were a lot of stories in North Dakota newspapers about families in the Williston area, for example, being so afraid of traffickers that they didn't want their daughters to go outside. And while that fear is understandable, given the way it was talked about and how it was relatively new in the public's public discourse, they probably would have been better off monitoring their social media sites, right, figuring out who they're talking to online, because that's how traffickers increasingly are reaching their victims, and they know who's vulnerable. And they know what signs to look for, and they grab onto that. So I think probably the advent of the internet and, again, especially social media has been the biggest change and a real boon to traffickers.
I've mentioned sort of, I would say, three players here that we see the vulnerable women and young and girls who are trafficked. Traffickers as a different group of people, and then those exploiters slash consumers slash buyers. And interestingly, Nikki, you just said that there hasn't been a lot of change in terms of who populates those three places as we go along. But maybe you could give us a little bit more insight, maybe Diane, about who are we? We've talked, I think, a bit about who the vulnerable people are, but who are traffickers, who are buyers?
So things have changed in terms of who are the traffickers and who are the buyers. And one of the very first thing we have to remember that this is based on basic business principles of supply and demand. So if the demand wants a certain market of women and girls, then the supply will meet that demand. Bottom line. And so That has changed and will continue to change as demographics change within a community, as the more we continue to objectify and commodify women in the media, women and girls in the media, et cetera, that will shift. And in fact, the National Task Force, when we launched our report in 2014, we said, Canada, wake up. Because this problem is not getting any better. In fact, it's getting worse. The girls, when I first started working on this issue, we were working with teenage victims who are 16. Today, our teenage victims, the average age is 13. We have 9-year-old and 10-year-olds. So the demand to sexually abuse girls and sexually exploit women are getting younger and younger. And while I would even say 15 years ago, it was really middle-class men who had a upper, you know, $80,000 or more income. But now it's every socioeconomic, every culture, every age even. There's 18, 19-year-old perpetrators to 60-year-old. And I've asked survivors, when you're, is this just like a few bad guys that just can't control themselves? Or is this just a whole bunch of bad people, bad men? And they said it's everybody. It's everybody from the guy with the car seat in the van to the guy on his way to work, in the company vehicle, to somebody having just enough money and no vehicle. And so it is a whole bunch. So that also has really changed the landscape of who is. And we also have to remember the criminal nature and how profitable this is. In Canada, the Canadian Intelligence Service released their intelligence on that a trafficker can earn, and a trafficker is the same thing as a pimp, can earn profit, $280,000 a year just for one girl, and many of them will have multiple, and so, up to four or five, and so that also is motivating the criminal nature of trafficking, and whereas some traffickers will want to hang on to one, most of them don't even care. They'll just go get another woman. Like, it's so... embedded into our society that we have normalized oftentimes by using words, again, like child prostitute. We minimize victimization when we when that happens. And so we've seen lots of things change over the years about who they are. And we're really at a point where it is a crisis. It is a major issue that we need to build the protective factors of girls in order to prevent sex trafficking, educate them younger. And we also need to work with boys and men on this issue and have raise confident boys. And there's also the sex trafficking of boys, which is another area that I'm not as familiar with. As girls, and so it has also changed because it's gone online. It's also changed because there are the word pimp is really not that cool anymore. In fact, they're not posing as pimps anymore. They're posing as boyfriends or friends, and they're using younger girls to become peer friends and to do the recruiting. So it's changing constantly, and that is really the important part of. Always being educated, because it will always continue to change. There are also what has changed is that more people are profiting off the sexual exploitation and trafficking of women and girls. You have hotels, taxi cab companies, massage parlors, which are just, that's another beast where the cities who regulate these places kind of act like a pimp or a trafficker in a legal way. And so there are... So it has changed a lot, and where we need, and the laws and the enforcement of the laws and the education and awareness are not at the same rate of evolving and moving forward as those things change.
You have a sense in the research you did here in North Dakota about this profitability angle, about sort of who all is in on it here in North Dakota?
I think what Diane is describing is true in North Dakota as well, and I imagine our next panel will be able to speak more directly with more information about that. So, no, I don't have a good sense personally about who the traffickers are, but in terms of the broader society benefiting from it, you know, absolutely. Hotel industries, truck stops, those kind of places. We all benefit from it in some way or another in terms of boosting the economy. It's part of our economy. But this is definitely, I see Emily Schwartz sitting right there. This should be addressed to her in the next session.
That kind of ties into, and Diane, I have to say that it was your comment about massage parlors. I always tell students, because I through my experience, right, it's the massage parlor with the closed out windows on a strip mall that you don't even think about and you drive past. For me, that always flies as a red flag just because of my knowledge base. But what should people be looking for? Not, it may be locations like that, but should be looking in terms of helping to identify whether they are interacting with someone who might be exploited. I mean, what are kind of factors and signs that they should look for in terms of trying to identify whether someone might be in need of help?
Well, I think we have so much power as consumers in our world on what we buy and what we don't buy. And so I hope nobody goes to massage parlors, for one. And you have a say in bylaw enforcement of whether those are even allowed in your community in the first place. And so you use your local voice to be part of that. And, you know, it's not always easy, but one of the things that I stress at the presentations that I make, oftentimes sex trafficking and sexual exploitation is moving more online, so there's less street. However, but if you see a girl, you know she's under 18, and you suspect you know that she's being sexually exploited, then oftentimes people just don't do anything. They just keep driving because they think that's somebody else's problem. You're actually witnessing a crime take place, and you need to call 911. And if we had more people that are making reports of witnessing crime, then that only results in, we've been successful in Manitoba, where we have one of the rare policing agencies in Canada that has a counter-sexual exploitation unit department. And that's what they do all day, all night, is they are looking at ending sexual exploitation and trafficking in our cities. Hundreds of exploiters, perpetrators, whether it's prostitution legislation or other forms of charges. This is what they dedicate. There's like five officers full-time that are working on this because it's seen as a crime that is really important to make investments in, to do something about. And so when there are, again, you wouldn't approach if you suspect there is a woman. There are ways to make sure that her safety is the most important thing. And so you wouldn't compromise that, just like you wouldn't compromise a woman who you know is living in a domestic violent situation where there's opportunities to get her alone, to talk to her, without putting her at risk. And there are certainly, if you are seeing something, it's not always reporting to the police either. If you're seeing a crime take place, report it to the police. There are also ways for people to volunteer or donate to organizations that are out there doing outreach and working with victims. And I would contact them if you see suspicious things in your neighborhood. A local women's organization is probably already on it and probably could benefit from the intelligence that you have. Whether you are volunteering or whether you are donating your time or your money, all of that matters. And so there are safe ways in which to approach, whether it's an adult or whether it's a child, and I encourage you to educate yourself. Another really important thing, and we're seeing a trend in terms of what is changing, is that when girls are being trafficked while they're living at home, so as a parent, you need to be aware of what the signs are, and there are lots of resources that are out there. You just go to the Tresia's Trust or the Mom Wichita Center website, and we'll tell you as a parent what to look out for and know if your own daughter or son is being trafficked while living at home. This is how it's also growing into more of a crisis situation because traffickers are no longer, they're not missing kids anymore. They're being trafficked while they're going to school even. And so that is on the rise. So it's education is important from all aspects as a parent, as a citizen. And there are ways in which you can be involved in very safe ways as well because that is a really important part of it because of the nature of trafficking and the criminal nature of trafficking.
Both of you have mentioned the idea of outreach, and I'm curious to know who you are outreaching to. I'm listening to both of you talk about hotels and cabs and these sorts of things. I'm reminded of stories that percolated in the news over the last year. The Uber driver who reported on a young girl who he thought was questionable called the police, and then they go and they uncover it. The stewardess of the airline who saw a weird got a weird vibe off of a girl and sort of did some of these things. So who should be reaching out? Or is anybody reaching out to try to get and educate people? Not just who are interested in this, but who are the most likely to be intersecting with individuals, hotel workers, cab drivers, the like?
There are certainly organizations that are doing that. I mean, various organizations within North Dakota that are doing trainings around the state with law enforcement, with hotel providers, with, who names it, anybody who might be likely to intersect. My own work tends to be more to the general public and general education. And oftentimes I'll say to them, our job is not to have this fantasy world of rescue, because I think a lot of people, they care passionately and they want to rescue somebody who's being exploited. I mean, that term is problematic in itself, but that's not our job as regular citizens. I think what we can do and should do, and this is the kind of training, if you'd call it that, but more education that I do, is make them aware of what's going on. The things that Diane's talking about, words like teen prostitute versus, victim of sex trafficking, trying to educate our sons about how to treat women and girls respectfully, trying to create empathy in terms of our LGBT, especially our trans community, people who, again, are overrepresented. So there are lots of organizations doing doing that outreach to people who should be able to intercept and make the calls. But if we don't have this on the radar of the general public, nothing's going to change, because our service providers and our law enforcement and our lawyers are not enough. There has to be public will to bring this to an end, and we can do it. I mean, at least African-American slavery, ended with the passage of the 13th Amendment, not because we just had a Congress that passed it, but because the people said it had to be done. So until we can at least generate some interest and, I think, passion amongst our citizens to say we cannot allow this to be going on in our world, it's going to just continue.
Hi, and so outreach is critically important, and I would... and again, I can speak more to my experience in Winnipeg, because really we're not, there's no other comparable place in the country that does the level of grassroots organizing on this particular issue. In fact, Manitoba was the only province for 16 years that had a provincial strategy on addressing sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. The only one. Where we're a little province, I know it looks big, but there's not a lot of people. 1.2 million people live in Manitoba, and we invest $11 million annually into a provincial strategy. There is the province that just in 2016 launched a provincial strategy is Ontario. And their strategy is $75 million, which if they were to scale up just to the same as Manitoba, you're looking at $250 million they would need, even just, and that still is just a drop in a bucket. We can't even keep up with the level of sexual exploitation and trafficking, that because we're aware, we see it all the time. Like, we know what we're looking for. We can see it, you know, right away, and we are reporting it. And local community responses are the most powerful. And there are outreach teams. We have, two of the largest ones in Winnipeg. Is a group of organizations, and police are a part of that. People within the province are a part of it, and it's the Sexually Exploited Youth Community Coalition. And then there is a network that was just actually in the news all this past week called the Winnipeg Outreach Network, which are actual frontline outreach workers, only them, so I don't sit there, because they're the ones that are their eyes and ears and the feet on the street and online. And the police also sit on that outreach network. And there are 18 organizations who, because they coordinated themselves, do 24/7 outreach now. And they are coordinating and sharing information with police, the Counter Sexual Exploitation Unit. And there's real power when you have grassroots people, both at all different levels, looking at it from what is happening on the streets to what is happening, where there are opportunities within the law. Through that coalition, we had a campaign during the Grey Cup called Buying Sex is Not a Sport. And we had a whole education part, and taxicabs actually got on board. There's stickers in Winnipeg taxicabs to educate people and where to call on human trafficking. We have a Manitoba human trafficking hotline. And we have the hotels were educated. We had posters and signs and online T-shirts, the whole kind of marketing PR that is possible during sporting events. So we started with the Grey Cup, and we do it every time there is a sporting event because there is a connection. We actually did research on during the Grey Cup, where on average there'd be on Backpage 50 ads for on selling sexual services. The day of the Grey Cup, that went up to 250. The day after the Grey Cup went down to 100, and then a couple days later went back to the 50. And so we know that there's a connection to any time you have men with money who are transient, you're going to have sex trafficking, and that could be resource development communities, large sporting events, anything that is going to bring men with money that are transient, that don't always live there. There will be a level of sex trafficking. And so we can never underestimate the power of local community outreach and knowledge. And the last thing I'll say about outreach teams is that there is nothing more powerful than having survivors lead. And that people walk with them or behind them in supporting their work. The Rural Healing Lodge and the Safe House that we operate, 50% of the staff are women with lived experience, because there is something really powerful between an adult who is helping a young person, because when they say, you don't understand what I'm going through, in fact, they do understand. And so that is a really special relationship, and that's a special relationship that also needs to happen at the front lines, at the outreach level. And so any work that we do in Manitoba must have survivors sitting at the table and in meaningful ways, and not just as a token, and not just because you can say they are actually, they are leading, and we are the helpers.
So much in there. It's really interesting. I'll tell you a statistic from the United States that might be of interest to you, Diane, which is that the one day of the year that is the most violent for women in America is Super Bowl Sunday. So it is the most violent day, you know, by hospital visits and everything else. So the connection between sports and violence is real here in the United States as well. I'm interested in this connection about outreach and thinking about, I'm professing my age here, but Johns, you know, that's what I think. I think about buyers as Johns, which is the difficulty in terms of how wonderful it would be if we could outreach to them. And I love this, you know, buying sex is not a sport is trying to reach them directly. But I'm thinking also of kind of old school things like John schools, where they go and they need to listen to somebody. But the difficulties that are faced when the population themselves is, as you said, transient. And I think, Nikki, you probably have something to say to that, because, I mean, we became aware of the issue of trafficking in North Dakota because of the influx of men being paid well who were transient. I mean, who were coming just for oil work. Would you agree with sort of what Diana said about that issue?
Yes and no. I mean, certainly there's a history would back that up, that when you do see these large populations of transient men, you do see rates of trafficking increase. But I also think it's very important that we don't let ourselves off the hook. I mean, our buyers are local, oftentimes. And I imagine our next panel can speak to that with more clear statistics. But it is, I usually tell people, North Dakotans are the buyers. I mean, they are here. Sure, they travel. I mean, there was just a big study out of Minnesota where the typical buyer was a middle-aged, middle-class white man traveling, you know, an hour or so during lunch to get to make his purchase. So these are not strangers that are coming and doing bad things. Sure, sometimes they weren't in the boom. We did have an influx of people, but I sometimes will say it's a North Dakota problem with a North Dakota solution. Like, we can address this within our own community as much as possible, and it starts with, I do think, talking to potential Johns. And there's different kinds of Johns, of course. There's those who are habitual buyers. It's going to be very hard to convince them, even if you highlight all of the exploitation, it's going to be hard to convince them to stop. There's situational buyers that might be in a situation like a hunting show or a fishing trip or whatever it might be, who might be convinced. And there's evidence that the Johns schools in North Dakota now has one in place, do have a lower rate of recidivism for those who graduate from that program. So there's hope there that their education can change minds. I also just want to add, in terms of, and I don't think we've really talked about it yet, in terms of changing attitudes, we've got to change the conversation too, because I think we're, at least in North Dakota, at a relatively early stage of talking about this. I mean, it's been going on for years now, of course, the conversations, but we also have to look at the underlying issues. We have to talk about poverty. We have to talk about mental health services. We have to talk about foster care systems, the resources that are given into these places, because until we fix those problems, again, this will continue. It's, yes, misogyny and exploitation and the all of that is a huge part of it, but there's also underlying issues that make people more vulnerable to this. And we need our legislatures to be supporting those things with fiscal notes, and we need to be talking about it as a community as well.
With regards to what we, you know, like I said, with the buyers, we have noticed that it could be anybody. And again, I'll get into language. In Manitoba, we also don't use the word Johns, because that also minimizes what they're the victimization, that they're committing a crime. So what people who commit a crime are offenders. And so that's what they're referred to. And when you start, and we spend a lot of time, and we still work with media constantly, that when you're, we don't say prostitution unless we're referring to prostitution legislation. We don't call them prostitutes. We say these are sexually exploited women. That's why you don't hear me say sex trade or sex work, because they're sexually exploited women, or they are victims of sex trafficking. You know, they fit one or the other category. And when you, and what is important is that the really the sex industry, and it's an industry because multiple people profit off the sexual exploitation and trafficking. It's these are the, but the sex industry has really sold us a and brainwashed many people to think that, oh, it's just two adults behind closed doors, no problem. That it's and she can do whatever she wants with her body, and you know, and if he's paying for it and they both agree and consent, you know, it's not a problem. But it is a problem. And where the major problem lies is what our survivors are telling us about those individual incidences that happen, where they actually refer to when that door opens and he walks in, you're looking at 15 to 30 minutes as they describe as individual incidences of paid rape. Of it is extremely violent. It is humiliating. And the then at the end of it, he doesn't want to pay. So then she's having to jump in front of the door and put herself more at risk to get the money that they agreed on. And once she gets whatever she is able to get out of him, that door open, he walks out, she's got 15 minutes, and then the next guy walks in for the exact same thing over and over again. And so those are really important to understand what is happening behind, like what are we supporting when we're saying, when we're minimizing language? And it's very dangerous to minimize the role of the job. I even have problems calling them buyers and consumers, because that's like, you know, that's mainstream language where it's like they are supporting an economy, but they are supporting it's an illegal activity. And it is violence against women, period. And so when we start calling it what it is, we reframe it. And when we reframe it, we are inspired to do things differently, to create laws, to enforce the laws we even have, for one. And in our task force report, we talk about very specifically that all forms of sexual exploitation of women need to be criminalized, period. Whether it's the right across the board in terms of prostitution legislation, massage parlors, you know, et cetera, because this needs to be viewed as violence against women. And once we put it and set it into that rightful category and context, then everything else changes, and we can move towards a safer, move toward at least one step safer, particularly for women and girls. And I completely agree with, we have to address poverty. Women still need money. Like, you know, even with the current situation where we talk about women having no choice, well, we need to give them choices. There needs to be choices for them when the rent is due at the end of the month, or when they need to put food on their table. There needs to be those resources and that safety net, that proper safety net in place for women and girls.
More questions. I'm sure you do too. So I'm going to kick it to you all. Does anybody in the audience want to take a moment to ask a question?
It's violence against women. When you talk to survivors, I've been working on this issue for 20 years. I have not met one woman who was not exploited either financially or harmed in some way, or didn't have some past experience with abuse that created vulnerability. Not one in 20 years. And so if there is a small population, we don't base laws in societal change so a few people can benefit when so many others are victimized. And I feel very strongly about that.
I'll just add to it that at least in terms of academics and the research that's going on, there is not a lot of consensus about the issues, but increasing numbers of studies show that in places where it has been legalized, rates of trafficking increase. Because legalization increases demand, it increases visibility, and when there's more demand, you need to have the supply, right? You need to increase the supply, and the cheapest way to do that is to get slave labor. And so even in places like the Netherlands, you'll see increasing numbers of trafficking victims there, right on in the same red light district, and it's hard to regulate that. I am a feminist scholar, and I've read the literature. I hear the arguments of sex workers' rights advocates. I understand where they're coming from in terms of labor protections. I personally tend to agree more with Diane about the very nature of the commercial sex industry. But I think these are important conversations we have to have. I mean, the biggest difference, at least probably on an individual level, between somebody who has been exploited and a trafficking victim and somebody who identifies as an autonomous sex worker is the last one can leave whenever they want, right? They can get out of that situation, where those who are exploited cannot. They don't have that luxury. So those people do exist. It's the few, I agree. But they have a loud lobby. They have a strong opinion. And we do need to listen to what they're saying and figure out. I think sex workers' rights advocates do not support trafficking. I mean, they don't want anybody not to be consenting to the work that they see themselves doing. But I mean, I think this is really frustrating to my students, especially because we spend a long time talking about trafficking, and then we introduce the sex workers' rights argument, and it's like, well, wait a minute, what do we do now about this? And I don't have the answer. I mean, it's other than to say we need to listen to all sides and see what the common ground is.
And legalizing would really only make pimps and traffickers entrepreneurs. That's what happens.
We do talk about the Swedish model a little bit. We don't, unfortunately. It's the class I teach it in as a survey course, so there's never enough time. In fact, on Tuesday, those students are going to be having a debate about legalization in the United States. And this is another instance where clear definitions of terms is essential, because you will see experts talking about legalization in the same breath as they're talking about decriminalization, and they're different things. So I think my students tend to, at the end of that unit, to support that Swedish model where selling sex is decriminalized. You will not. I mean, we're really moving in this direction anyway with safe harbor laws, right? Where if you are a minor engaged in the commercial sex industry, you are a victim in need of services. I don't know. I imagine our next panel might have some clear ideas about if we're moving in the direction of decriminalization in the United States for adults. But I think my students tend to lean more towards that as opposed to legalization, and they tend not to support criminalization because they see that as putting the women, you know, it's not all women, of course, but majority women in a precarious situation. And, you know, we had talked about changes, and I think one recent development in the last 10 to 20 years is that law enforcement is using their discretion whether or not to charge or arrest the people engaged in the actual selling of sex. That's a step forward, but it's still a law. And historically, it was the women engaged in prostitution that were arrested, that were punished for this, rather than the buyers, rather than the sellers or the traffickers. So, yes, we do talk about it a bit. They tend to support that, but I think they probably walk away with more questions than answers, which for me as an educator is the best place to be.
Yeah, that's so, and that is, again, part of how, the normalization of everything, because if you are a child under the age of 18 and you're considered a sexually exploited youth, and then your 18th birthday, now you're the woman of the night, and now it's prostitution. There are some really harmful complexities to that, depending on where you are in Canada, on not viewing and taking into consideration the childhood sexual exploitation and that evolving, which is all part of it. It all, traffickers target young girls for two reasons, because of the demand and because it's easier, and because they're young and et cetera. So It's critically important. Like Winnipeg, again, is just one of the rare places where we know so much about that dynamic and that and her as a child coming into an adult, and then when the sexual exploitation or sex trafficking continues and when it ends, because it does end at some point in a woman's life. And so that dynamic between 18 and under 18 and over 18 would be harmful in a place like Ontario, Saskatchewan, where even child welfare legislation only goes up to 16, and there's little or no safety net if you're 15 and a half to 18. And it's even more normalized in those areas. But in Winnipeg or in Manitoba, if you are 17 and a half even, or the day before your 18th birthday, services will kick in and they will be extended as a result of that. And so we also, again, have very unique services for sexually exploited women who are 18. And because we know that sexually exploited women who are 18, chances are they've been sexually exploited since they were little. And this is 18 doesn't matter. But it's, again, that education and setting up, making sure that safety net is there will depend on where you are in Canada and how well they do it. And most places do it awful.
You know, this is one of the things that drives me crazy. And, again, I think the next group of people up here will be able to speak to this in more detail. But this, too, is where public perception is so essential, that we increasingly have sympathy for children who are sexually exploited, but as soon as it's an adult that we're talking about, that sympathy goes out the door. And this is, you know, it's slut shaming, right? It's part of rape culture. It's all of that. And I think we need to change those attitudes, because we ignore then that childhood trauma that's never been addressed and that has continued throughout their lives. So how is that individual supposed to, all of a sudden they're 18, they can just walk away? That's just not that simple. So, yeah, it's frustrating on many levels for me as well.
I'm going to, Stephen, point that over to lunch, if that's okay. If you would join me, please, in thanking our wonderful panelists, Nikki and Diane, for joining us today.